Now. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
Here is the premise of this program and of this entire production house. In point of fact, everything is an economic story. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday today, the third day of May. Good as always to have you along. Everybody, we are going to leave the political and legal parts of the story of the day today to others and take up the economic and corporate reality of reproductive rights. With those rights set to be overruled, as Politico reports, more and more companies are saying they're going to help their employees with the costs of traveling out of state for medical procedures, including abortions. And that has corporate America weighing in on one of the most divisive issues in America. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes gets us going.
Laura Speakerman is co-founder and chief revenue officer at Alloy, a startup that sells identity services to banks and fintech companies. And she feels responsible for her 250 employees who work around the country. That's why this past January, the company announced it would put money towards helping employees access abortions.
This is another way in which employers have to take care of their team members.
Alloy will contribute up to $1,500 towards travel expenses for an employee or an employee's partner to get an abortion, and also help cover legal expenses or out-of-network costs around the procedure. Speakerman said this benefit makes the company a more attractive employer, though she did worry about deterring clients.
I think I'd be lying if I said I wasn't nervous, especially because we have banks in more conservative states and in states where these anti-choice bills have been rolled out. I still felt like it was worth taking that risk.
Other companies are taking the risk too and creating their own policies around this, including Amazon, Citigroup, and Match. And there may also be pressure to provide support for women no matter what happens, says Rita McGrath, a professor at Columbia Business School.
So, you know, if I'm forced to have a child, then you're going to be forced to bear some of the burden, might be the attitude you'll see there.
That includes robust parental policies, including paid leave, along with predictable hours. While these policies could be helpful to employees at the companies that have them, most of the workforce will be left out. Carrie N. Baker is a professor of women and gender at Smith College.
So, I mean, it's very common that workers that work for more, you know, resourced companies have access to more benefits.
Baker says it's important to keep in mind that 75% of women who obtain abortions in the U.S. don't make much money and are unlikely to work for a bank or a startup. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
This is perhaps an awkward turn to make, but the calendar sadly does not wait. The Federal Reserve started a two-day meeting today, after which tomorrow about this time, you're going to hear me telling you about the Fed raising its benchmark interest rate half a percentage point as it tries to get inflation under control. How long, though, until we actually feel something happening? Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has that one.
The first response in the economy to a rate hike is going to happen so fast that if you blink, you might. Surprise, it already happened.
Mortgage rates have gone up by all the way to 5% now. So they've gone up 2 percentage points just in the past couple of months.
Ken Kuttner is professor of economics at Williams College. 30-year mortgages take into account not just what interest rates are, but what we think they'll be. And it was pretty clear months ago that the Fed would be raising rates.
You're probably not going to see any additional movement in that mortgage rate unless the Fed starts moving faster than the markets had previously anticipated.
Another effect of tomorrow's probable interest rate hike, that is yesterday's news, the stock market. The S&P 500 is down 12-ish% this year. Some of that is everybody saw rate hikes coming. Bill English is professor of finance at Yale.
Stocks are, in effect, a promise to pay dividends out in the future somewhere. But if interest rates are high, those future dividends are worth less today, so stock prices fall.
New loans will become more expensive pretty quick with higher rates, including for the government. Jens Nordvig is CEO of Exante Data.
The government also has to pay interest on its debt. As these interest rates rise,
Now, just because we are seeing rapid changes in the economy does not mean we will see rapid results when it comes to inflation. All of these things take time to filter down to everyone's spending decisions, possibly a year or two. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, just waiting for Jay Powell again. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Out to Beverly Hills we go now, something called the Milken Institute Global Conference. 4 days of mostly business and finance panels and conversations, one of which was me with Ambassador Catherine Tai, the U.S. Trade Representative. We went half an hour, the ambassador and I did. We'll play a couple of parts of that talk today. The global part of global trade comes first.
A couple of months ago, about a month ago, you said to the Senate, the version of globalization that we have right now is fragile,
yes.
Right? And it feeds on our insecurities. Mm. What does that mean, and why do you think that?
All right. Let's talk about globalization, and lots of people talk about it, but it is important to try to define it. So the version of globalization that we have right now, let's just call it globalization 1.0.
Yep.
It is one through the trade lens that I see that is built on a set of assumptions. And there were very reasonable assumptions, I think, that we had, say, coming out of World War II, which is the more that we trade with each other, the more trade that you can facilitate and liberalize, the better off we all will be. You may have heard people say, countries that trade with each other don't go to war with each other.
I have heard that.
Okay. Now, I think that in the last 2 months, we've seen that that's not necessarily true. So, you know, I think that that's one data point I would highlight. Another one is around the pandemic and the supply chain struggles that we have had, starting with the scramble for PPE to today with a global economic trading system that just remains discombobulated. Shanghai and certain parts of China under lockdown again. We know that these are going to ripple out across the global economy. So this is globalization 1.0, built on the notion that trade liberalization leads to the promised land. And where we find ourselves is not the promised land today in 2022, but in a state of feeling a global fragility and heightened sense of insecurity.
So look, you mentioned Russia, and that's the obvious one, right? The hot war. But let's get to a trade war, which has to take us to China and the efforts we've had for two generations in this country to get them into the global trading system. And by doing that, get them to change their behavior. And certainly we have the Trump tariffs, which we'll get to in a minute. I wonder what your sense is of how we're doing with the Chinese. You've said it's dysfunctional. It doesn't work. Our relationship with the Chinese doesn't work.
I don't know that that's the word that, I mean, dysfunctional I will reserve for my description of the World Trade Organization.
That's a whole different thing, but okay, fair enough.
I choose my words very carefully when I talk about China and the U.S.-China relationship.
Sorry, let me get the quote right.
Yes,
right?
Okay.
Thank you. Unduly difficult.
Yes,
is
difficult.
How you described our relationship with the Chinese.
It is very difficult, especially
unduly
right now.
Unduly difficult.
Sure.
Explain that.
I think that our relationship on a bilateral basis has become more complicated over time. As I experience it through the trade lens, I'll take as an example, because I think that you're going to take me here anyway, so let me just preemptively
get there. That's like cheating. I don't know if you're allowed to do that.
It's called taking control of the conversation. Ah. So back in October, I announced the administration's approach to the U.S.-China bilateral trade relationship and that we would be beginning our direct engagement with a focus on China's performance under the set of commitments it had made to the U.S. government in what we call by shorthand the Phase One Agreement,
right.
But it's the U.S.-China Trade and Economic Agreement that was signed back in February of early in 2020.
Of which they have completed how much? There's
Well, I mean, so, you know, the picture is also varied and complicated. There are a number of different types of commitments that China took on. Many of them related to their intellectual property protections and their forced tech transfer. So that is a set of commitments that we've been tracking. And you look at whether or not they've passed the laws and regulations that they promised to. In large part, they have. But then you also have to assess for all the companies that are on the ground in China, are they seeing an improved environment in China? And, well, you know, that's going to be up to the experiences of our companies and what they share with us. It's going to be a little harder to measure than, for example, the purchase commitments that the Chinese made. And those everybody is following. We get lots of questions about it because the trade data are public. You can look at the numbers in terms of their commitments on paper, and you can see where there are gaps.
Do you think that the Trump-era tariffs have changed China's behavior?
In certain ways, yes. I think that another question would be whether or not those tariffs have changed firm behavior. And again, I think that in a way you also see changed behavior.
Explain that a little bit. Firm behavior, American firms? Or
sure, American firms, yes. Anybody who is trying to source from China and bring that product into the U.S. has got to contend with this set of tariffs that was built up starting in 2018.
Yep.
What stakeholders have told me is that increasingly firms are engaging in what in the industry is called a China plus one strategy.
Yeah.
Where, you know, if you're going to be making things in China and you're going to be selling to the Chinese market, you continue to do that in China. But if you are making things in China and you are going to try to sell that either back to the U.S. or in two other places, firms have seen this situation and have been incentivized to find other bases of operation and manufacturing where they feel that there might be more confidence in terms of the trading relationship to getting that product out of China and into the U.S.
Firms tell you that. Business people that I speak with express incredible frustration with having to actually go through that after having built up their supply chains over decades now. Mm-hmm. And they also wonder why it is that the Biden administration has not decided to get rid of the Trump-era tariffs and save that those import taxes on $300 billion worth of Chinese goods. What's your answer?
So I think that frustration comes from a couple different places. One is a sense of inconvenience. One may be a sense that, in a way, maybe we all wish that we could go back to the way the world was in 2015. That was a version of globalization 1.0 where we were not worried about putting in an order for, I don't know, a piece of furniture or a pair of pants and having to wait 6 months for it to arrive, right? And I think that, you know, what I would say to all of our firms who understandably, and all of our people too, who understandably are sentimental, is that the reason why we are where we are today is that this world was not built for resilience. And so, you know, I think that the issue that we're dealing with right now is we want to transition from globalization 1.0 to globalization 2.0. And I think that, you know, the really interesting conversation is around what does globalization 2.0 look like?
Well, so that's the question, right? Let me stop you there and say you've described 1.0 and what it looks like and the fragilities. What is 2.0? And more importantly, does it spare us the fragilities?
That would be the idea. In the new version of globalization, our firms, our governments need to be focused on decision-making and behaviors that are not just focused on efficiency, chasing the lowest cost, right?
Right.
But where we're all incentivized to reward and build towards resilience. And what does resilience mean? Resilience means more choices, more options, less vulnerability, and ultimately being better prepared because you don't know where that next crisis is going to come. You don't know its nature, so you just need to be prepared.
The U.S. Trade Representative, Ambassador Katherine Tai, version 1.0, if you will, version 2.0, coming up later on after the fold. Coming up.
We all remember the Great Recession.
Well, yeah. First, though, let's do the numbers.
Dow Industrial's up 67 points today, about 0.2%, 33,128 for the blue chips. NASDAQ up 27 points, again, 0.2%, closed at 12,563. The S&P 500 climbed 20 points, about 0.5%, 41.75. Pfizer picked up 1.9% today on better-than-expected first-quarter profit and revenue. Biogen dipped 0.75% as the drug maker's first-quarter profits and earnings missed analyst expectations. The education services company Chegg tumbled more than 30% after cutting its full-year revenue outlook. It said current economic challenges are prompting consumers to prioritize, quote, earning over learning, which can't be good if you're an education company. Bond prices were up. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note down 2.98%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns. Meaning, when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal. Rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. We were talking about the Fed meeting this week. Well, yes, Sabri was earlier in the program. And the 0.5 percentage point increase that is all but certain to come out of it, which is big and important, but kind of only half the story. Here's Chair Powell at his last press conference back in the middle of March.
There's also the shrinkage of the balance sheet, which people do the math different ways, but that might be the equivalent of another rate increase.
Balance sheet. Powell said it 14 times that day. This one you're about to hear being the most important.
We expect to begin reducing the size of our balance sheet at a coming meeting.
That coming meeting, of course, is the one today and tomorrow. So, a brief but necessary, we believe, balance sheet explainer.
My name is Kathy Zhang. I'm an associate professor at Purdue University in the economics department.
We start with the basics.
The Fed's balance sheet is going to be a financial statement that's, in fact, updated weekly, and it shows what the U.S. Central Bank owns and owes.
As of the most recent update last week, the Fed's balance sheet sits at just shy of $9 trillion. There are assets.
Treasuries, securities.
Government bonds, right, and mortgage-backed securities. Also,
U.S. paper currency, as well as money that the different commercial banks hold in accounts at the Fed.
Paper currency, by the way, Federal Reserve notes. It says so right on them. How that's a Fed liability is a whole nother explainer, probably. But anyway, the Fed's balance sheet has more than doubled since the start of the pandemic. And a little bit of history might help here.
We all remember the Great Recession around 2008.
We do indeed, most of us anyway. Ben Bernanke was the chair of the Fed, and the Federal Reserve cut the federal funds rate, the short-term rate it controls, from 5.25% in September 2007 to a range of 0 to 0.25%, basically nothing, by the end of 2008.
But there's only so much you can cut interest rates by. So once you hit zero, you're at a lower bound. And so that wasn't enough to stimulate the economy. And so what the Fed did was they turned to more unconventional tools.
Enter stage right, the Fed's balance sheet, which for the first time, it really started using.
It started buying a lot of long-term treasuries and federal agency debts and also mortgage-backed securities. And the idea of this was to increase the Fed's balance sheet in order to increase the availability of credit.
Quantitative easing is the phrase you have surely heard to describe that. But the important thing here is that credit is the lifeblood of this economy. It means businesses can take out loans and grow and hire and keep workers. It means you can get a mortgage or a car loan. So by 2015, the Fed's balance sheet was $4.5 trillion. It had been less than $1 trillion before the Great Recession. But by 2017, almost a full decade after the start of the financial crisis, the Federal Reserve decided the economy didn't really need so much of that extra help anymore, and it started reducing the size of its balance sheet. Not buying new treasuries and securities, just running off what it had. Tapering, it was called. But that got complicated in a hurry. Markets had a little taper tantrum, maybe you've heard that, and the Fed backed off of its plans, which gets us to today and the Fed shrinking its balance sheet again, we think.
With even the levels of the current balance sheet, I mean, these are going to be big market moves.
Which is why Kathy Zhang and a whole lot of other people are going to be paying pretty close attention to what Powell says tomorrow, more attention than usual, really, about dates and the amount of tapering, round two, of course, that the Fed is going to be doing.
I'm a little worried about the effects on financial markets, whether this is going to be just like a temporary shock or a more long-lasting one. That'll depend a lot on what their announced schedule is.
Kathy Zhang at Purdue, taper tantrum and interest rates and all that jazz tomorrow on this program. Back we go to the Milken Institute Global Conference, where yesterday, in between the hobnobbing and the schmoozing, that was other people, not me, I spent a half an hour on stage with Ambassador Catherine Tai, the U.S. Trade Representative, talking in this section about the domestic side of global trade.
I can't see the screens, but when we were walking in, I noticed your Twitter handle was up there and mine was up there as well. And you or I'm going to assume your staff tweeted at me this morning and said, can't wait to join Kai Rizdal at Milken to talk about the Biden-Harris administration's worker-focused trade policies. You have to convince the American public that trade is a good thing. Mm. Go.
Okay. Well,
you've got 90 seconds,
but all right, let's start with this. I think that a lot of the American public either isn't thinking about trade, or if they think about it, have a sense that people in this job are not thinking about them, and frankly, haven't thought about them in decades and haven't designed globalization 1.0 for them.
You want to know why? And we talked about this again last time you were on Marketplace,
I know,
right? Because we could go out on Wilshire Boulevard and stop 10 people.
Yeah.
And if we said global trade, they would say, oh, God, tariffs. I hate trade.
Kai, I think that we really need to go out and test
that out. We should just do it, actually.
We really need to test it because I take your point.
We should have done like Jimmy Kimmel thing and gone out there. Anyway.
I take your point that I question your numbers.
It would be 9.5 out of 10.
Well, you see, I don't know how to define half a person, but let's take your point that people are associating trade with tariffs right now. Well, there are a ton of people out there who associate trade with offshoring and outsourcing and the loss of jobs and the loss of a significant amount of America's manufacturing industrial base. We have globalization 1.0 is built on catering to a human element that we have only conceptualized as the consumer. Mm-hmm. Right? So a lot of the arguments around the benefits of trade are you're going to have low prices and lots of variety at the marketplace.
Right.
All right. And yeah, no, I mean, there's a luxury to that and something that we've enjoyed for a long time.
But people
are not just consumers. They are also workers. They're also earning money, and they are also having to compete in a global marketplace for talent where globalization 1.0 has really eroded opportunities and wages for your average American. So the point that I have to make is, I get this. From now going forward, as we devise our trade policies, we are going to be thinking about the human component of our economy centrally, and we are going to be thinking about how we justify our policies to benefit our people. And if the policies we're thinking about don't benefit our people, then those cannot be the policies that we pursue.
So let me back you up for a second. Mm-hmm. The idea that we've come to think of, or that low prices are a luxury, right? I would submit that the American consumer certainly thinks it's their right. I've always had low prices. Mm. And now you're going to change that?
Yeah.
What are you going to give me in return?
I'm going to give you a sense of security and confidence that clearly have been broken in this moment, which is, and I wish I'd looked this up because I've been thinking about this part of The Great Gatsby. Near the very, very, very end.
Cecil Slee into the past or whatever it is?
Not that part. Not that where Nick Carraway says something like, you know, the revelation that the rock of the world is founded on a fairy's wing.
Huh.
It was much more beautiful because F. Scott Fitzgerald. But I'm close. I've got most of the words in there, right? So there is a sense of confidence and strength that we had and, you know, this right to low prices that was built on something that was very fragile. I think going forward in terms of globalization 2.0, we need to have those hard conversations. A more resilient, a stronger, more sustainable future is one that is going to look different and feel different. But the focus that we have is on ensuring that the rock of the world is actually founded on a rock. One that is better prepared for the next challenge, and one that has a kind of an insurance that is built into it to make sure that the next time there's a crisis, we don't have that panic and sense of desperation that we have been experiencing for the last couple years.
Do you think we can do it?
I think that, I absolutely think that we can do it.
The U.S. Trade Representative Ambassador Catherine Tai with me out at Milken yesterday. A very quick part three coming up on this program tomorrow. This final note on the way out today in which men are terrible. Saw this in the Washington Post today. Research from the journal Work, Employment, and Society showing that as earnings for women with children increased from zero to half of household income, the number of hours of housework those mothers do declined from 18 to 14 hours a week. But then, after she makes more than her husband does, that mother's housework increases to almost 16 hours a week. Here's the kicker. As his wife starts to make more than he does and is doing more housework, oh, by the way, a man's housework goes down from an already low level of 6 to 8 hours a week. I'm telling you, men are terrible. Holy cow, we gotta go. Too much meat today. Our digital and on-demand team includes Kerry Barber, Siobhan Brett, Dylan Mieten, and Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Donatam, and Tony Wagner. Made it. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.